We actually, it was the first time we were supposed to go to Calgary at Christmas, but then Omicron came down on everyone. And so we didn't. Mm-hmm. So I actually went to Calgary for Christmas in July.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
Did you have a gift exchange and stuff like that? Christmas dinner?
We put the lights up. We cut down an evergreen tree.
You did?
No, I'm just kidding. We just did a gift exchange. And yeah,
fun.
It was good. Mm-hmm.
Christmas in July. I've heard of it before, but mm-hmm. I've never done it.
It's proverbially fun. Right?
What does that
like
mean?
Something is like Christmas in July?
Oh, yeah. I guess so.
Like something's so good, it's like Christmas in July. Isn't that a thing?
Yeah, I think that's a thing.
Yeah.
So you went to Calgary and it was like Christmas in July?
Yes.
I get it. Well, I didn't go to Calgary. I just made ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of ice cream all week.
Yeah. Business is booming.
Yeah, it's been a real busy week.
Mm-hmm.
It's good though.
I'm going to make some sorbet tomorrow.
Are you?
Yeah.
What flavor?
Sour cherry.
Oh, nice. Right. Of course.
But here's my question for you.
Okay.
I really haven't done it very much. So I pulled out my baking and pastry book and reread mm-hmm. the frozen desserts section. Sugar concentration is key, right? For texture.
Oh, yeah.
But then how do you, like, sugar concentration is key for texture, but then there's also, like, the flavor considerations. So right. When I read through the recipes, the concentration of sugar in the lemon sorbet is, like, double the concentration of the sugar in the grapefruit. And that makes sense, like, to balance out the acidity. But then, mm-hmm. like, doesn't it mess with the texture?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's... Yeah. Like you're going to, yeah, exactly. If you make those two recipes mm-hmm. and churn them both, mm-hmm. you're going to wind up with two totally different textures of mm-hmm. sorbet. So
I was working, like I have Evan's cherry juice and I've made a base. I just used a recipe for grapefruit sorbet that uses grapefruit juice and subbed in the cherry. And so I'm pretty sure I have a good sugar concentration.
Mm-hmm.
But when I taste
what is
it,
the sugar concentration, if you don't mind my asking?
Oh, I actually, oh, so this is from the CIA baking and pastry book, and they have a recipe for a sorbet syrup that's 65 degrees Brix.
Okay.
And the recipe for the grapefruit, it's not quite this, but it almost calls for 1-to-1 grapefruit juice to the sorbet syrup. Does that?
Well, I don't measure any, like, I don't know what 65 Brix is.
Okay, good.
Which is probably a horrible admission.
Yeah.
Or a horrible admission. But we don't measure any of our formulas in Brix. Mm-hmm. And so I don't exactly know what that means. I'm assuming what is that, like a heavy, it's a pretty heavy syrup, right?
I can go get the recipe if you want to go that far into it, or
is it like 1-to-1 or is it more than 2-to, like, or is it more than 1-to-1 sugar to, and is it just, is the sorbet syrup? Yeah, go get the book. Go get the book, otherwise we can't really talk about it.
Okay, so they have the sorbet syrup recipe, mm-hmm. and then they have like 10 different recipes that call for the sorbet syrup.
Yeah.
And then those recipes will also perhaps call for a little bit of extra water or something to control the concentration. So
yeah,
the sorbet syrup itself, and this is 65 degrees Brix, is... roughly one part water to 1.5 parts sugar.
Okay.
And then a little bit of extra glucose.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, it's a pretty heavy syrup. So, and then mm-hmm. you're saying that the grapefruit sorbet recipe is basically one part grapefruit juice, one part sorbet syrup.
Almost. Yeah, it's like, for instance, 15 ounces grapefruit juice and 12 ounces of the syrup. And then there's also a little bit of water in the recipe too. So,
oh, so it's quite a bit less syrup actually than than water and juice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. Well, so okay. So the thing is that like different sugars are going to give you different consistencies, and mostly when we're making sorbets at Kind, we're using like mostly sucrose, like mostly simple syrup in varying concentrations. And then we also have a sorbet syrup that we use to help adjust texture a little bit. And it has more corn syrup in it, which, you know, contains some glucose, some fructose. But yeah, it's like invert sugar. So it will tend to make things softer without without changing the sweetness as much. You know, if you wanted to, like, you know, perfect the recipe's sweetness and texture, then what you would do is, like, you would probably make a regular simple syrup and add enough grapefruit juice to it that it was like the right sweetness, keeping in mind that obviously you're going to be eating it cold and the sweetness comes across a lot less when things are really cold, you know. Like it doesn't taste as sweet as quickly because it has to melt in your mouth in order for that sweetness to come out. And so it doesn't, it won't taste as aggressively sweet when it's cold. But then, so you could adjust the recipe, like the ratio of simple syrup and grapefruit juice, to the liking of your palate, and then churn that and see what the texture is like. And then you could adjust the texture by reducing the amount of syrup and adding glucose. If you wanted it, if you wanted the texture to be softer or less icy, you could add a little bit less syrup and replace that with glucose.
And would you be doing that on a one-to-one?
I mean, that's probably where I'd start in terms of experimenting with it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'd take out, you know, 50 grams of syrup and put in 50 grams of glucose or something like that. And that would make it less sweet and softer or something like that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Because, yeah, when I tasted, I have the base made. And when I taste it, it just doesn't taste sour to me. It tastes... It's like the sugar has just like clobbered the acidity of the cherry into submission. But maybe, like you said, it'll taste different once it's actually churned.
Probably. I mean, the other trick that we use, and even in, so we have like a cherry slushy sorbet on our menu right now. And it's meant to taste quite sweet because it's meant to taste like a cherry slushy. But it, like... most of our sorbets and some of our ice creams that are meant to taste like, that are meant to taste like fruit that has some acidity to it.
Yeah.
We usually wind up adjusting the acidity with citric acid.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
You know, which doesn't really make sense when you're using like, when you're using citrus, you know, like that seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But like to get enough flavor of the specific citrus fruit, like you have to put quite a bit of like the fresh fruit juice, and we use usually the zest as well to try and get as much of flavor of the fruit as possible. And then we just from there have to sort of like adjust the acidity, you know, after making, because like how we usually get our citrus flavors too is like we usually make a citrus syrup.
Oh, okay.
And then the citrus syrup is like a concentrated, like a lemon syrup is like the concentrated flavor syrup that we use to make our lemon and jammy raspberry dairy-free ice cream taste like lemon. And because it's like this concentrated syrup with a lot of zest in it, you don't need a ton of it in the recipe to make the ice cream taste like lemon. So that's usually what we do. We start with like a flavored syrup that's pretty concentrated in flavor, and then we'll adjust the texture and the acidity and things like that by either, you know, using different amounts of sugar and or, you know, also, if you're going to put like inclusions in it, that can make a difference to the texture as well. And then also we'll adjust the flavor with a little bit of citric acid if it needs it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So that would be my recommendation is like make some, churn some, see what it's like when it's cold. If it doesn't have that punch that you want, then you can just back add some citric acid.
Mm-hmm.
Did you use the grapefruit? Or oh, no, you're using cherries. Duh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what citric acid is going to make cherries taste like. It might make them taste too citrusy. Mm-hmm. You might. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that I, like there's been other, because I'm trying to, we've kind of talked about this before actually, like trying to do a lot of classical preparations with our local sour cherries. I think we talked about it doing like a lemon curd, sorry, in the style of a tarte au citron right. with the sour cherries. And even today I was making pâte de fruits with the sour cherries and like all the recipes, even like no matter what fruit you're using, they all call for citric acid powder.
Okay.
And I just didn't use it because I was like, well, I know that it's supposed to help like with the, like the pectin setting and stuff, but like, I just want it to taste like cherry. So I didn't use it, but it seemed to work out just fine. But
yeah.
Yeah. Anyways,
It's worth like, you know, it's worth a little taste, you know, try a little bit with some citric acid in it and see, you know, because sometimes it makes such a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Like our key lime pie ice cream has like, you know, it has a pretty good lime flavor and stuff. But like it, when we first started making it, like it needed some punch and adding citric acid to that like really makes a huge difference. Like it makes it feel tart, you know?
Yeah. I think that it, I'm sure there's a line that can be crossed, but like using the citric acid, I don't think it's necessarily going to make everything taste like lemon or citrus. Like it's almost like a seasoning, like
it's
right?
It's fairly neutral. Yeah. Like it's a fairly neutral acidic flavor, you know?
But like just to give the acidity that bit of boost so that as soon as it hits the palate, like it's right there. Okay, well, to be continued. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, definitely.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sutterby, and I'm here with my good friend, Shale McDonald. Hi, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Yes, we do.
Seeing as we just recorded a 20-minute intro, yes. We do.
And we embarrassingly love to talk about it too much.
Did you have any
follow-up or anything?
Yeah.
Not really. Do you have any follow-up?
No.
I have one non-topic item that I kind of wanted to just like run by you before we get into our actual topic.
Okay.
And it's this. I posted something in the Slack. I don't know if you saw it or not. But
oh, something about hot chicken. Yeah. Is that right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna read you a little bit of a blurb. I think this is just a story about this from a news site. Looks like some kind of blog. I have no idea where it is. It's just the first thing that came up when I Googled this. I don't know if this is the original source that I saw this on or what, but my sister showed it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read you the headline. Swiss Chalet introduces new Nashville hot crispy chicken ice cream sandwich for dine-in only.
Is it a typo or?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Nashville hot crispy chicken sandwich. Sorry, Nashville hot crispy chicken ice cream sandwich for dine-in only.
Do you know what Shelley takes?
Go ahead.
Sorry, what that makes me think of is, when I was at U of A, there was this kind of scandal or incident where the student newspaper, The Gateway, the editors of the newspaper used to do is put something called a Hitler bomb into the text of various articles so that the junior editors, when they're proofing a story, they see a random Heil Hitler in the text. Mm-hmm. It needs to be removed, obviously, but the senior editors would do this to train the junior editors, and one of them slipped through. And oh, so in a random part of an article in the Gateway, it said Heil Hitler with an exclamation point. And to me, what you just read sounds like someone just added ice cream bombs. Like, that sentence makes sense to me, except that the word ice cream is in it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a hot chicken sandwich? No, a hot chicken ice cream sandwich.
Ice cream sandwich.
That was a weird tangent, sorry.
That's okay. That's unfortunate, though, about the Gateway.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe use some different text to train your junior editors to pull things out of articles.
Because even just writing the word garden gnome or something, that's not going to, like... That's
exactly. Something that's innocuous.
Yeah.
Yeah. That whole situation seems like it probably taught the senior editors more about something than the junior editor.
Yeah. Sorry, but is this like a press release that you're reading?
Well, no, this is just a news story, and I couldn't actually, well, like in the very short amount of time that I had before we got on the podcast, I tried to look for the original press release, but I couldn't find it. I'm sure it exists, but, but yeah, I'll read you some of this story. So Swiss Chalet takes their chicken sandwich game to a new level with the introduction of the new Nashville Hot Crispy Chicken Ice Cream Sandwich as part of the brand's new Nashville Hot Inspired Chicken Crispy Chicken menu. Mm-hmm. Nashville Hot Inspired. So clearly not actually hot, so don't get your hopes up. Available for dine-in only, the Nashville Hot Crispy Chicken Ice Cream Sandwich features a Canadian chicken breast tossed with new Nashville Hot Glaze, which is not really how hot chicken sandwiches are, sort of. I don't know. On a toasted bun and topped with a scoop of vanilla ice cream that's drizzled with honey.
Oh.
In addition to the new Nashville Hot Crispy Chicken Ice Cream Sandwich, the Nashville Hot Inspired Crispy Chicken menu also includes a Nashville Hot Crispy Chicken Sandwich, Nashville Hot Chicken Tenders, and Nashville Hot Chicken Wings, which can be enjoyed for both dine-in and takeout. Swiss Chalet's Nashville Hot lineup can be found at participating locations across Canada through August 7th. So my question for you is, Alan, would you eat this?
So it's not an ice cream sandwich. It's a sandwich with ice cream on it.
It's a chicken sandwich with ice cream on it. Yeah.
On top of
that should have been my first question. When I say Nashville hot crispy chicken ice cream sandwich.
Oh God, stop saying Nashville.
What pops into your head when I say that? Like, is it an ice cream sandwich? Is it a chicken sandwich with ice cream?
I assumed it was an ice cream sandwich.
With chicken
flavored like Nashville hot chicken.
Oh my God.
I don't know. Nashville hot chicken ice cream sandwich. To me, yeah, my mind says, okay, well, it's an ice cream sandwich, but it's a Nashville.
Yeah, makes sense because chicken. The words ice cream sandwich are in it.
Yeah. And they're together.
Yeah.
And sorry, it's like a scoop of ice cream on top of a constructed sandwich. Like it's just on of the, and then you
take
eat it with
chicken
a knife
burger.
And fork. Yeah.
And then remove the lettuce and put in a scoop of vanilla ice cream with honey on it.
It's inside. So yeah. you do pick it up and eat, like
you pick up
the bun, the ice cream's inside. And the ice cream is melting all over the place as you do it.
I would hope so. Because if it's not, then the chicken's probably really cold and gross.
Mm-hmm. What's the so it's like a Nashville hot chicken sandwich with cream in it, with a sweet cream sauce inside.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I'm sure the ice cream isn't going to melt immediately. I'm sure you get a couple bites that have like sort of melted ice cream and some non-melted ice cream or something like that.
Okay, so first of all, obviously, I should hate this.
But you're curious, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I do hate it because it's like a gimmick.
All right.
But like, if you think about the flavors involved. It's clearly
novelty food. And I ate hot chicken in Nashville and I don't ever remember there being like an ice cream association with it. So I'm not really sure where they got this idea. Maybe that is a thing at a hot chicken restaurant in Nashville somewhere. I just don't know. But
like some really fiery chicken with honey sweetened cream, like flavor wise, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like,
I don't know about the vanilla part. Yeah,
fair enough. A cooling contrast. I mean, obviously I hate it, but there might be some sound flavor dynamics at play here.
Okay, Alan, will you go eat one with me?
Is there a participating restaurant near us?
Oh man, I have no idea.
That was the segue into our sponsor placement, whatever it's called.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so is there any other ice cream related topics you want to
Yeah, let's check out the actual topic. This is the all ice cream all day show.
The actual topic, we were gonna I drafted a menu for Ernest Dining Room for the fall of this year. Mm-hmm. I drafted it I think sometime in May, and then I started to even test some of the dishes in June, but then I got COVID and so I couldn't go to work and I couldn't do any work at home. So I honestly, I just sent you a copy. I don't know if you saw, or a short while ago.
I did see it. This is a draft of your menu.
Yeah. It's a draft.
And we're going to go through and look at it and edit it. There better not be any Heil Hitlers in here, Alan, or I'm going to be very upset.
Because I think we did this last, roughly this time last year, right? Like, with the same,
yeah, we did a very similar thing last year. Maybe it might have been a little closer to the actual rollout last year. But.
Yeah. So I actually have not even read this since I drafted it and sent it to my supervisors in early June or so.
So you haven't even gone back and looked at this in light of your stage or anything like
right,
that.
Right. Yeah. And we mentioned in the last episode, that was something I was really keen to do. So yeah, we're going to do it together.
Oh, that's great. I'm excited.
How do we do it? I can't remember what we did last time. Do I read the whole thing or do I just read item by item?
I think we go through it item by item. Cause if you read the whole thing, it'll, you know, we won't really remember what you read.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's a draft, so there's a lot of unanswered questions, just like there was last year. So we've got same structure. It's six starters and six mains. Mm-hmm. And the first starter, all I have is chicken ravioli in broth.
Okay.
The idea is that it's a play on chicken noodle soup. There was a handful of classic techniques or preparations that I wanted to sneak onto the menu just because it's culinary school. One of them was mousseline. And so the idea was to make chicken ravioli like that are filled with a chicken mousseline.
Okay.
And then possibly the broth, depending on, I don't know how realistic this is, but the other thing that I've been wanting to get on a menu as a consomme. I didn't write consomme on the menu, but potentially this broth could be a consomme.
Okay. It's going to be a chicken broth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So it is, it's a soup course. It's not a pasta course. So it would be just probably like three small ravioli with the chicken mousseline. And then I thought it would be, I didn't think this through yet, but I thought it would be fun to somehow hearken to chicken. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I boring you?
Nobody needs to know that I yawned, but now everyone does, Alan.
An obnoxious yawn. I'm just kidding. If there's some way to like, hearken to the chicken noodle soup and like the other garnishes in the broth are like carrot and celery or something. If there's a way to do that without it coming off as boring, but that's the idea.
Okay. So my first thought is that for me, and I don't know, you let me know how you feel about this, but for me, the better raviolis and the more exciting raviolis that I've had have something that's, you know, has a surprising texture inside.
Okay.
Right. And I feel like potentially a mousseline could provide that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like potentially also it could wind up just sort of feeling like a ricotta stuffed ravioli or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think that there are a lot of sort of factors at work that will, you know, kind of make it go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I think for like softer fillings, which the mousseline I think would be in the category of, you want to have like as thin a pasta layer as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that I think is going to be one of the challenges, like getting the texture of the thickness of the pasta and the texture of the mousseline right, so that it doesn't feel mushy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be something that I would probably be focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, like you say, the idea of consommé, and especially because it's cooking school, it's like, it sounds nice and it could be really pretty and it could look like very modern and stuff. I'm trying to think of like chicken noodle soup related things that you could have as garnishes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when I'm thinking of chicken noodle soup, yeah, I'm thinking of carrots,
celery,
onions, and yeah,
dried herbs. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which doesn't sound very exciting. And like sounds like working with those things sounds like it might be kind of difficult to differentiate it or make it seem like more modern or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think cutting carrots and celery into shapes is going to do it for you, you know, like there's definitely some brainstorming along those lines that's going to need to happen.
There could be like celery oil floated on it.
Yeah, that might be nice. I think that's a really good idea. And celery leaves potentially or something as a garnish. And yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, to me, probably it seems counterintuitive because it's a soup course. It seems counterintuitive that you would, you know, like the focus would have to be like making the texture of the garnish the sort of focus, but I think that, you know, that's where you're going to wind up, like to make it a delicious, surprising, like exciting dish, you're going to have to get the texture of the ravioli like perfect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you have an idea for that, like how you want to make the mousseline, or things that you might want to include? Would it just be like raviolis with piped mousseline in it, or would you potentially add something else as well to like provide additional texture or something like that?
I was thinking like really classic mousseline. It would be chicken, cream, egg, like in the whatever it is, 8-8-4-1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly green onion. But and maybe herb, like I don't know what, like parsley and tarragon or something. But yeah, I hadn't planned to add much more than that.
Okay.
And then yeah, I had
like I would think that to make it substantial, you would want to make it quite tight. You might want to change the ratio a little bit or something, like more chicken meat or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then like yeah, we have a good working pasta dough recipe. We would dial in the thickness. And then for shaping, I wasn't sure if it would look better if it were like, it could be ravioli del plin, like the ones that end up as kind of like serrated little squares that look kind of like a pillow with serrated edges.
Yeah.
Or it could just be like little round, little UFO shapes, little circles. But again, haven't really thought it through.
Yeah, executed well, it could be amazing. I feel like. And I also think that consommé is a good way to go too, because then it's also like surprisingly flavorful, right? Like people will, yeah, you know, it looks like this clear broth, but then you get this incredible richness. And then, yeah, floating some really well flavored like oil on top of it or something like that is going to give you something real pretty and elegant. And
we'll see.
Yeah. That one is pretty vague. So I feel like that one could be the one that, like, you know, gets a lot of sort of rehash. The rest of these look like they're fleshed out a little bit more than that.
Yes. But, yeah. Yeah. Like they actually have descriptive copy. Yep.
Yeah.
So the salad course, the way it's written right now is quinoa salad with confit cherry tomatoes, melon, cucumber, sprouted chickpea, cumin, and lime.
Okay. Cumin, lime. So confit cherry tomatoes. Yeah, I understand. So you're going to peel and confit some cherry tomatoes?
Yep. Blanch, peel, and then in quotation marks, confit in olive oil until they're kind of like almost like semi-dried and shriveled up a little bit. Yeah, like
little tomato raisins almost or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But softer than raisins.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And then melon.
This one I have actually, yeah, sorry. This one I have actually, I did a test of.
Okay.
The melon, like I used cantaloupe. And then.
Which is like the worst melon when it's not great. And yes. The best melon when it's amazing. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want me to tell you what I did for the test, or do you want to try and, or like think about how you would make this just based on the description?
Yeah. Well, when you said confit cherry tomato, that's pretty much what I had in mind. That's pretty much what sprung to mind. Okay. Let's see here. I mean, there are like a 1001 possibilities for how you could put these components together. So I think it'll be weird for me to try and guess the one way in which you did it.
Oh yeah. No, you don't have to guess. I just meant like if you had.
Yeah. If I had my druthers, what would I do? Let's see. Like when I'm trying to make this into a fine dining dish, I'm like struggling a little bit because everything that keeps springing to mind is sort of like some kind of tabbouleh-esque sort of.
It's a deli salad kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, also, I don't think I've ever like sprouted chickpeas or worked with sprouted chickpeas. Is that something you're going to be sprouting them on? Like you're going to be using dried chickpeas and sprouting them?
Yeah, that was the idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never done that. So I don't exactly know what the texture is like. I'm assuming it's like soaked chickpea, but maybe with a little bit more sort of green vegetal kind of, or crispiness or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I'm also not really seeing anything that's like a dressing necessarily. I'm assuming that the lime has something to do with the dressing, and the cumin probably has something to do with the dressing as well, potentially.
That was the idea.
So I think I would probably toss the cucumbers and cherry tomatoes, or marinate the cucumbers and cherry tomatoes potentially in the dressing, and have those be kind of one component. And then I would probably try to sort of like build some kind of structural element out of some quinoa that's also dressed with the dressing. And then I would probably have the sprouted chickpeas as sort of like a garnish that's kind of around the salad but on the plate or something like that. And then the melon shaved on top, maybe, as like a little nested kind of salad garnish or something like that. That's sort of what I'm picturing. Mm-hmm. But it also, when it, like, while I'm talking about that, it doesn't necessarily seem super cohesive. So yeah, I'm sure that once I got that on the plate, I would have to be like, I'd have to be trying to figure out how to sort of pull it all together or something like that. And it also seems fairly obvious to put the tomatoes and the cucumbers together and marinate them with the dressing, and it might be more fun to do something that's a little more surprising, like having, and also I don't think I've had much like tomato and like tomato together with melon.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about how that flavor combination works, and it might be more interesting to put the tomato with the cantaloupe if it actually works flavor wise or something like that. But yeah,
it's something like I had seen dishes in the past that have tomato paired with some kind of fruit, and it always sounded like, it just in my mind, it seemed like a clash, like it was like two different kind of types of acidity that I didn't, it just, it seemed really odd to me.
Yeah, that's it. But that's it for me too. It's like the acidity of the tomato seems like it would like emphasize the wrong parts of the flavor of the fruit.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
I kept seeing it. We're going to get 1,000.
All of our listeners are going to write in and tell me that tomatoes are fruits. Yeah. Look, I know tomatoes are fruits, okay? Yeah, but they're vegetables, okay? Can we all agree on that? They're fruits, but they're vegetables.
And rhubarb is a fruit, right? Tomatoes are vegetables.
Rhubarb is definitely a fruit, 100%. Yeah,
okay, good. I'm glad we agree.
It grows out of the ground just like a fruit.
Anyways, I kept seeing it and I was like, I'm going to try it. And I really, really liked it. So the way the test that I did, what did I do? I had a little bit of butter leaf on a plate. I had the quinoa itself. I dressed and seasoned. I can't remember. I think I put a little bit of red onion in it, but otherwise I just like put the quinoa onto the butter leaf, and then all of these other components I like seasoned or dressed, and then just kind of nestled into or on top of the quinoa.
Decorated the bed of quinoa with all of the individual little garnishes.
Yeah, exactly. And I ended up like trying to make everything round. So you have the round, the round confit cherry tomatoes. For the cantaloupe, I sliced it into pieces like a quarter inch thick or so, and then punched circles out of it with a ring cutter, and compressed those circles. So that was,
that's cool.
And then the cucumber, I was using like the baby cucumbers, so just shaved on or sliced on the mandolin, so they're round. Sprouted chickpeas, round. And I think when I did my plate, and I have a picture of it so we can put it on our Instagram, I also did I also did radish on it. So another like pretty little round thing.
Garnish.
All that trim from punching the melons, I juiced and used that to make the lime and cumin dressing.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great.
And then also, not in the description, but had kind of went wild with herbs too. Like there was mint and parsley and stuff in it. It tasted really, I thought it tasted really good. There was two things though. Sprouted chickpeas are gross.
Oh, that's too bad.
I saw them. This dish is kind of inspired by a couscous salad that's in the first 11 Madison Park cookbook, and it has sprouted chickpeas on it. And so I didn't even know that you could sprout like dried chickpeas. I didn't know that they were still alive. But they have like, the flavor is okay. Like you said, like that kind of green vegetal leguminous, whatever flavor.
Yeah.
But they're like quite hard, like really crunchy, and have like a fairly odd, like starchy aspect of them, which makes sense, but like kind of like having cornstarch, almost like raw jicama, actually, like that kind of cornstarch feeling in your mouth. So I think that
wonder if you sprouted them for longer, if that would change, and like how easy it would be to control, like how long they need to be sprouted for before they're like palatable or whatever.
I should test that. Like the ones that I sprouted, they ended up with like the tails were twice the length of the chickpea itself. So to me, that's quite so far along. That's
pretty far along, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely could see how far you can take that. So the tentative idea was to maybe instead of sprouted chickpeas, it's like crispy chickpeas or something like that.
Well, that was the other thing I was going to say is it would probably make sense to have something crispy on it. So maybe crispy quinoa or potentially crispy chickpeas. Mm-hmm. I don't know though. Like I like crispy chickpeas in a rustic dish.
Yeah.
But I feel like to add the kind of crispiness that you would want for something that's a little more like upscale, mm-hmm. you would want to, I don't know, you'd want to find a really good method for making the chickpeas like really crispy and very,
I think I know what you mean, like that they often end up being a little bit more crunchy than like, and not crunchy like a potato chip, but like there's something not purely brittle about it that like is a little bit, I know what you mean.
And it can be a little bit mealy or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd want to try to potentially find a way around that, I think, which I don't know, maybe there is one. I haven't messed around with it too much. And I've had like really good crispy chickpeas before.
Oh, is there?
But, yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a great, I've made it a few times and it's always been okay, but it's never mm-hmm. been mind blowing for me, but you want like a corn nuts texture, right?
Well, maybe like corn nuts are pretty hard, you know,
I haven't had them in a while. That's how
I feel about them.
But they're much more brittle than...
Yeah, more brittle, for sure. Yeah, exactly. More brittle than what you would maybe normally encounter. I don't know, like, maybe there's a cook/dehydrate/fry method that could get them, like, super crispy or something like that. Like, it's the same way that you would do crispy quinoa or something like that. Or like crispy rice or something like that, where you like cook it and then you really dehydrate it until it's like practically dry again, till it's like 10% water content or something like that, and then fry it and have it puff. Like I've never tried that with chickpeas, but maybe it could work.
I did try that this summer actually. And it didn't work, but it didn't work because they didn't puff in the fry, like in the fryer, they didn't puff. And I don't know if it's just because like they still have like kind of their seed coat or whatever it is on them or what, but they were almost inedible. That's what I was thinking, like the kind of, we talked about the like chicharron kind of method for making like rice mm-hmm. crackers or tapioca crackers. And I thought maybe you could do that with just like intact chickpeas, but it was a fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too bad. There's gotta be a way though.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the only other thing for this dish that I was wondering about, and maybe it's just making it all too complicated, but I had come across some like smoked, grain dishes, like smoked mm-hmm. couscous and smoked barley. I was wondering if just to kind of like round out the savoriness of this, like if the quinoa were smoked.
That's interesting. I mean, even lightly, like super lightly, might be something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'd definitely be worth messing around with. I don't know, like, is that also, like, if you're going to go in that direction, then I'm not sure if the melon, you know, like.
To me, it's like.
If you're trying to make it more savory or something, then like, it sort of plays against what the melon is bringing, I feel like, but.
But I'm thinking about like melon and prosciutto. I know prosciutto is not usually smoked, but like melon and prosciutto, melon and ham, melon and bacon. It makes sense to me, but I don't know.
Well, then you should cure the melon with maple syrup and smoke the melon.
Melon bacon.
Melon bacon. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, it's possible we may only get through the appetizer section tonight.
Yeah, that's okay.
This might have to be, we might have to split it up because there's a lot to say about this, and I don't want to get short shrift either and just be like, let's not talk about this one, you know?
I'm okay with that. But
the other thing that I was going to say, this is just a little side note, for the melon, I don't know exactly what kind of size you're looking for, but a really good method for getting rounds of like something that's sort of like a larger piece of food is to cut out a cylinder with like an apple corer. You know what I'm talking about when I say an apple core? Like one of those, like handheld sort of like circular knives for cutting your core out of an apple or whatever.
Yeah, I know what an apple core is. Yeah.
If you use that to make like to cut out cylinders of your melon, then you can just cross cut them into circles, and it's a lot faster than like cutting slices of melon and then having to cut out individual circles. You get like, you get the right circle diameter immediately, and then you just have to cross cut that a bunch of times. It's a lot faster.
And so
it might not be the right size though.
Right.
But
so would you skin and have the melon and then just like go wild on the melon half with the apple core? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I'd find the right way to get as long a pieces as possible with the melon core or with the apple core, you know? So like whether that's like around the edges of the melon, you might want to go in one direction and then, or like you might want to like cut the melon so that it's mostly like, so that the inside, the indentation where all the seeds are and stuff is just like, you cut that off and then use the corer to like core out all the flat part and then go around the outside of the part where the seeds were
from the
other direction or something, just to get as long a pieces as possible. And then just take all those long cylindrical pieces and then cross cut them with a knife.
Yeah, totally.
Probably be a lot faster.
Yeah. I bet you're right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm curious to see where that winds up too, and I'm curious to see the photo because I also have not seen it yet. So,
oh, is there? Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. If you post that, I'll
get
to see it. I like the smoke idea too. I think it's I think it's like probably a unique idea. It's just the matter of incorporating it in the right way so that it doesn't seem cloying or tacked on or
There was a chef at Nate actually who was doing her certified chef de cuisine exam this summer. And I know that she had a smoked, I think it was Israeli couscous on her menu. Oh. And I haven't talked to her about how it turned out, but she has a method. So I'm going to follow up with her on that.
Cool. You just throw liquid smoke in the water when you're cooking it, Alan. That's the jokes. It's jokes. Yeah.
The next dish, here's what we got. It says smoked trout rillette, and the rillette is in quotation marks.
Okay.
And the description is creme fraiche, horseradish, dill, pickled radish, cucumber, and flaxseed crackers.
Okay.
And to be totally honest, I think I read a descriptive copy very similar to this on a Boondock menu recently.
Oh,
like
really?
Where it was like smoked trout rillette, and it definitely had horseradish, and I can't remember what else, but that really interested me, and so I stole a lot of it and tried to make my own dish. I haven't eaten it or seen their dish, but I'm pretty sure that was the like kernel at the center of this idea, was just reading a Boondock menu.
Okay. The smoked trout rillette, I guess I have a pretty good idea of how you would execute that. Do you know, are you going to be smoking this trout yourself, or are you going to be trying to buy like a smoked trout product, like an Alberta smoked trout product? I know that those have existed at various points, but
I don't think they exist now because there's no commercial, there's no commercial fishing in Alberta anymore. There might still be products coming out of the Northwest Territories. I'm sure that there are smoked trout products on the market because I've seen them at Nate. I didn't really think it would be nice to do it ourselves, but I don't know. It could go either way, I think, depending on the workload for the other menu items. And
so this is going to be a hot smoked fish, and then it's going to be flaked, and then turned into a rillette using probably like the creme fraiche to bind it.
That's the idea. Yes. That's why rillette is in quotation marks, because it's not really a rillette, but
but
it's the same, a similar kind of
Yeah, that all sounds great. Flaxseed cracker, you're going to soak some flax seeds and lay them out between parchment or something, dry them, dehydrate them. You'll get like kind of a wavy cracker situation or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I've came across that technique in the Favikin cookbook, but apparently it's like really common in all kinds of, like, especially for like gluten-free diets and keto diets, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And then the dill will probably be in the rillette and also used as a garnish, mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. And the horseradish in the rillette maybe as well, a little bit, but then maybe something else as well, or
yeah, maybe as some kind of garnish, yeah.
Like a fresh horseradish cream or something, or
yeah. Yeah, or fresh, like just fresh grated.
Grated horseradish, yeah. I mean, you have cucumber on both of these dishes. Also, I was going to say, you know, since this dish is like smoked, is there anything else on the menu that's smoked?
There is some bacon vibes in some of these appetizers. Oh, yeah, so yeah, there's a lot of smoke going on. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe the quinoa salad doesn't necessarily need that also, mm-hmm. but.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I might consider trying to use something, besides cucumber, just because there's cucumber on the salad as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's like a really different cucumber preparation, then, you know, that probably doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are you thinking for the pickled radish? Because I think I know what I would do.
What?
Well, it's hard. So it's hard to pickle, like, if you're talking about, like, regular little cute little radishes or like, what are those like? Oh, right. They're called French radishes. Those cute little long ones or whatever.
Yeah. The French breakfast radishes.
French breakfast.
Or Avignon. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the problem with pickling radish is that the color bleeds.
Yes.
Quite a bit.
You lose that nice contrast between the red ring. Yeah.
And so if it was the pickling part of it that was important, I would probably use daikon and then mm-hmm. cut it into like some interesting shape or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then pickle daikon and then potentially you could like recolor it a radishy color using like beet juice or something like that.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. That's probably what I would do, or just leave it like pure white if you didn't need the pop of color. Mm-hmm. But kind of probably part of the reason why radish is on this dish is for that pop of color.
Yeah.
So I would either not pickle the radish and do something else with it where you can maintain that really nice like color contrast,
mm-hmm.
or I would start with a blank slate with white radish,
mm-hmm.
and then try to do something to, you know, do something interesting with the pickling and potentially recolor it or something like that.
I think the original idea was to use watermelon radish and to pickle so that you end up with that bright pinky fuchsia kind of.
Yeah, that could be great. Yeah, I think that, yeah, that's a great idea. And would you pickle it using like by compressing it, or is that sort of what you had in mind?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this sounds really nice, sounds delicious, and sounds pretty modern and like fairly easy to like make look very modern mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And this one I was able to do a test of. One, I can't remember the specifics very well, but one thing I will say is that the recipe for flaxseed crackers in the Favikin cookbook did not serve me very well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, like for instance, actually kind of like you said, they told you to roll out the flaxseed mixture between two pieces of parchment,
mm-hmm.
but it's such a wet, sticky mixture that
you can
roll it out between parchment fine, but then like you can't remove the parchment,
the parchments
without ruin, like it all just like gums up and sticks to the parchment. Like I actually felt I had been punked. Like It was so bad. It didn't even.
But then you would go to Favakin and spend like one day in the kitchen, and you they would be like, oh, can you just, we don't want you to get in the way. Just make this cracker, okay? You just got to roll out some.
Yeah.
You just got to roll out some flax seeds between two pieces of parchment, and then just pull the parchment apart, and then we'll dehydrate them. And it's yeah. fine. And then you would go to do it, and the flax seeds would like stick to both sides of the parchment. You would wind up with like some flax seeds over here and some flax seeds over here, and it would just like ball up into a big disgusting mess in the mm-hmm. middle of the parchment. And they'd be like, oh my God, you are the most useless cook I have ever seen in my life. And then they would come over and like they would just walk over, take the exact same things that you were using, the same parchment, the same flaxseed. They would lay it out. Mm-hmm. They would rip the parchment off. Everything would be totally perfect. And you'd yeah. be like, oh my God, I am the friggin' worst. That's exactly how it is when you...
yeah.
Like, it probably is like... doable in the way that they say it is, but it just like takes this like little bit of practice, and then you're like, oh, I see what happens here or something, or like,
or like they have slightly, or the different
flaxseed just has to be a slightly different texture or something, yeah. like, you know, to what you're getting, and maybe that has to do with like, you know, their recipe, like maybe their flaxseeds are just slightly drier and you need to add a little bit less water or mm-hmm. something, you know, like who knows, right? Mm-hmm. But it's about all those like tiny little details, like knowing the texture that the smashed flax seeds should have before you roll them out on the parchment mm-hmm. or something. And, you know, it's just like these tiny little cues that you get after doing it a couple times. And you're like, okay, yeah, this is going to work, or no, this isn't.
Mm-hmm. One of the pastry chefs at work said, like when I told him how bad I had messed up these crackers, he said he makes them or like something like that all the time at home.
Okay.
He said, no, just like, don't roll it out between parchment. Just like put it on a silk pad or a piece of parchment, then use a palette knife and spread it out as thin as you can. And that yeah, works about 100 times better. So
yeah, totally.
That's for the and next.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's a like different approach that you can use too. Right. So,
mm-hmm. So like I said, I did do a test of this. I think for the test I did pickled beets. But they were like shaved and like they were beet rounds. So kind of the same, in a way, the same appearance that you would get from a pickled watermelon radish.
Gotcha.
One thing I was wondering, like if the perception of value would be better if instead of it being a rillette, which kind of like can just remind people in this case of basically like tuna salad or something, if it should just be like...
Really?
Well, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like it's shredded fish bound with here creme fraiche, but like,
yeah, I guess. Yeah. Okay.
It doesn't need to like, as long as the fish isn't overcooked and stuff, like it doesn't need to taste like tuna salad. It should be nice and moist and yeah, has good flavor with the creme fraiche and horseradish. But I was wondering if it would just like somehow play better if instead of it being busted up and mixed with creme fraiche, if it were just like maybe torn pieces of the smoked trout.
Right. Instead of making it a smoked trout rillette dish, yeah. just make it a smoked trout dish and just have pieces of the smoked trout and
yeah.
all the individual garnishes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The benefit, I think, of the rillette is that you can get a different texture. Like you can get... And this is going to be a cold dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if you're going to serve pieces of the trout, I feel like they would probably be more palatable if they were warm.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. They could be warmed. Like, everything could be cold, but the trout is warmed in the oven.
But the trout is warm. Yeah.
I don't know. It was just one thought.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. That tuna salad association.
Just me.
Just... I don't know. I don't know if it's just you, but it definitely wasn't me. Like,
mm-hmm. okay,
doesn't even register for me. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
And part of that I think is calling it rillette, and then I have an idea of what that is in my head. It's like, okay, this is going to be like, you know, like a fish pate kind of situation.
Yeah.
You know, like, mm-hmm. and I'm not really thinking of tuna salad, but
okay.
And then when you tested it yourself, did you just get a filet of trout and smoke it and break it up yourself? And also, like, are you hot? Like, I was assuming that it would be like hot smoked fish. So the fish is like cooked.
Yes. Yeah. And
smoking.
What
so that it would probably actually be like potentially what could be considered, like, if, you know, if you were just going to eat a trout fillet, by hot smoking it, you're going to be cooking it quite a bit more than you probably would if you were just like cooking it to serve it as a trout fillet, right?
Right. Yeah. So I just happened upon some, like, there was smoked trout fillets in a freezer at work. And so I thought,
And so they're like hot smoked and it's like fully cooked. It's
That in this, and if we were able to do it ourselves, like we could hot smoke it, but not cook it as far as these ones were.
Right. Or you could cold smoke it and just cook it to like where it's like tender and then do that. Like It's definitely an option.
So the
I think would probably bring a bit more kind of elegant texture to it.
Yeah. So that was another, like the test that I did, the rillette was a little bit, it came off as dry, even though there was so much creme fraiche in it, like because the fish had been cooked well done, it came off a little dry. So that might be the answer to your initial question of like, are you going to smoke the trout yourself? Like, I think that maybe for this to really be like moist and buttery trout, like maybe it's probably necessary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cold smoke it and then cook it in a really controlled way so that we can nail the finishing temperature. And
you might want to cure it ahead too, like a little bit, just like a very light, salting like a few hours before, just to tighten up the flesh before you cold smoke it, and then just like make it, give it a little bit more, give the flesh a little bit more body, I think, or something. Or brine it even, but that's kind of a thing, you know, then you have to
and this might depend on the sourcing, this might end up being char or something, like if I haven't
tried to source the trout that's the eternal question is like, okay, can I get a whole season's worth of trout that's going to be consistently good? Like it's not easy.
Like this time last year, because like Ocean Odyssey was bringing, like, had that steady stream of beautiful Icelandic char coming into Edmonton, and that got interrupted by COVID. So I don't know if it's back on, like you could only get frozen from them for a long while. So I don't know if things are starting to turn around or not, but.
When I was working in BC, we used to be able to get trout that was like aquaculture, like sustainably aquacultured, and they were beautiful fish and like pretty sizey, and like every one was just like this perfect little gem. I can't remember the name of the company that we were getting them for, like what the name of the farm was or something, but I'll bet there's still something like that where you can get cases of just like these perfect.
There was that, we talked about it I think in the last conversation, like there was farmed steelhead trout coming from, I believe it was called Little Cedar Falls on Vancouver Island, that they were using at Naramata Inn. I have no idea if that's available to us or not, but yeah, that's.
I don't know if I want to get into this right now because I feel really not very well informed about it, but isn't steelhead trout just like salmon?
As far as I'm concerned, like, I'm just going to leave it to the structural biologist to tell me whether it's actually a salmon or a trout. Like, I don't really care because we know what it is and what it tastes like.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. That's a thing. Like, there's about a billion online articles about arguing one way or another or trying to, anyways. Yes.
Right. Well, and I guess like for me, the distinction is that like, so steelhead trout are, like saltwater fish. And most of the trout that you would normally call trout and would say is trout and looks like trout is freshwater fish, right? And they don't ever.
Yes, you're right. The steelhead trout, it's not a saltwater fish. It's a
It's like a andromous salmon. Where,
It breeds. Yeah. It breeds in, or it spawns in freshwater, but
in freshwater, and then it lives in, goes saltwater. Back to saltwater. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yes.
Sorry. What's that word? You want to look it up?
I think it's Andromus.
Andromus. Okay.
Andromus.
Andromus.
I think. We'll have to look that up. Follow up.
Follow up for next episode.
I'm sure that that was a question on like a journeyman exam.
I'm sure you got it right.
Anyways, enough with the riette.
Yeah, sounds like a great dish. You know, strictly flaxseed crackers maybe would have a tendency to get stuck in people's teeth, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I don't know. You might want to kind of like workshop the cracker idea, but yeah.
Stuck in teeth? Question mark.
I do like flaxseed crackers, but yeah, once you put them in your mouth, they do start to revert to their kind of like mucilaginous kind of consistency or whatever, and then once that happens, the seeds, like even the broken ones, can start to get a little bit like, you know, like slippery on the outside, and they like, and then it's hard to keep mm-hmm. them out of your teeth and stuff like that, but
mm-hmm. okay,
but I do like them.
I did also, I was, when I wrote this, I was thinking about, you had talked about a seed cracker that was made, I can't remember, maybe at Fiskabar. I can't recall.
Yeah, at Fiskabar. Like,
which sounded really delicious, but I thought it was cool that the straight flaxseed cracker would be gluten-free.
Totally.
Whereas yours was more like a tuil with seeds studded through it, right?
Yes, that's exactly what it was. It's like a tuil dough and then completely covered in seeds. So like mm-hmm. you would spread the tuil dough over a whole sheet of parchment and then just like draw it through a bath of seeds, and they would completely mm-hmm. coat, and then you'd bake that in the oven until it was crispy. Mm-hmm. Which is a cool idea, but like you said, although I'm sure there's a way to make a gluten-free tuil dough that would work just totally. As well as what we were using.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah. Mm. And then you could use all kinds of seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Moving on. Next item. Fried green tomatoes.
Yeah. In quotation marks.
Okay.
Descriptive copy was bacon cornmeal gratin, buttermilk, pickled shallot, chive, and sunflower shoots.
Okay.
And this one I have sort of tried before. It needs to be workshopped.
Right.
But this was the vision, if you'll allow me.
Sure.
Green tomatoes sliced and then really lightly pickled. So they're cooked through, they've got a little bit of acidity and seasoning to them.
Okay.
And then I don't know if you remember, we've talked about this concept of the movable gratin, where you like make a gratin mixture on its own, like basically like we've been talking about, like rolling between acetate or between parchment, and it's just like a mixture of like butter and breadcrumb and whatever else, in this case maybe having crumbled bacon and chive and like grated cheese or something in it, roll it out, cut it to the desired shape, and then pop it onto these lightly pickled green tomatoes and then salamander it so that it crisps.
Right.
And so I just liked that idea because it was an interesting presentation idea to me, where like you get a plate with whatever it is, three different sizes of these green tomato rounds that have just like a perfect gratin on top of each of them. So I haven't actually executed it yet, but that was the vision.
Sounds tricky, but sounds potentially doable.
Mm-hmm.
If you're gonna pickle the tomatoes, maybe do something else with the shallots. Buttermilk, is that gonna be sort of like a sauce?
It would be something like, we've had buttermilk dressing on some other dishes we discussed, where it's like basically buttermilk thickened a little bit with sour cream, seasoned, and maybe it has cayenne or sriracha or something in it.
Whoa, sriracha. That's trendy, Alan. You sell a million of those.
Are you hoarding sriracha? Do you know about this?
No, I don't.
The sriracha plant in California is closed this season.
Oh, I do know about that, actually. Yeah.
because of the drought over the last few years, they haven't been able, they're not able to get enough chili peppers. So
yeah, that's rough.
Yeah.
Sriracha shortage.
Mm-hmm. So don't panic buy, but also.
I'll have something else. So I'll have some other hot sauce. Mm-hmm. Sunflower shoots. Yeah, that sounds like a nice garnish. The chive. Yeah, this sounds really nice if you can execute it correctly.
Mm. I don't know. I don't know if I can, but.
Yeah. I'd love to be able to like come and workshop a dish like this with you. It'd be so fun to just like try to figure out the right consistency for the figuring out how to make the gratin part of it work and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Besides the actual like getting the right texture so that it's like crisp and somewhat cohesive and not just like loose breadcrumbs, but also like one thing that maybe makes this dish not practical at all is like you would want to cut this pre-rolled gratin mix to be the same size as the
size as tomato, a tomato that doesn't like, actually have a fixed size.
Yeah, exactly.
And wherein the slices of it will be different sizes as
exactly.
well.
Yeah. So it might be a dumb idea for my purposes.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I also think that like the tricky part is going to be like, you know, like you can cut a perfect circle of this gratin material, shall we call it? And it can be the exact right size of the slice of tomato that you want to cover with it. Mm-hmm. But then when you go to gratin it, like, will it, you know, will the size slightly change, and or will it just start to look like you just piled some cheese and breadcrumbs on top of the tomato and gratin that
right.
like, and if you're just going to wind up with that look, then you might as well go back to square one and just do it that way, or actually do them fried or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I don't know. In like, I think it's a really cool idea if you get like a super clean edge and super perfectly like circular little piece of gratin material on top of the tomato that's like the exact right size.
Mm.
Like, I think that could be really cool, like a really neat presentation. But yeah, it sounds pretty tricky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it seems like it's an idea that's sort of been rattling around in your head for a while.
Yeah.
did you take a crack at doing something like this last year for the fall menu? Like some kind of movable gratin thing?
Yes. Not on the menu, I don't think. But
okay.
Like I did, I tried basically the tomato and gratin part of this dish.
Okay.
At some point about a year ago. I was kind of working off of this, the gratin mix was something from 11 Madison Park, and I just really wasn't happy with first of all, it wasn't cohesive at all. Like from reading about the dish that they were using it on, it was almost like a cheesy cracker kind of topping where like you had to cut through it. Even working from their recipe, like this one was, like you said, like it basically just played like I had put breadcrumbs on top. So it was like really loosey goosey and kind of not cohesive. And it didn't have a very satisfying crunch to it. Like it just like felt like buttered breadcrumbs, which was whatever. It tasted fine, but it didn't deliver on
what. It was not lending the effect that you were hoping for.
Yeah. And so that could be as simple like the, like maybe it's as simple as tweaking the recipe and the amount of whatever, the amount of butter to breadcrumb to cheese kind of ratio to get something that's a little bit more crunchy and cohesive.
Well, I feel like you'll probably have to bind it with something a little bit, you know, like the cheese probably kind of helps a little bit to bind it, but you might need to add something that's actually going to bind it and not, and that's not going to add like too much moisture so that it can get like quite crispy still. I'm not exactly sure what that would be in my head right off the top of my head. Like egg would not work.
Mm-hmm.
but maybe something like maybe you could take some of the breadcrumb and just like a little bit of the breadcrumb and moisturize it with something and blend it until it's sort of like a thick paste, and then use that as a, like a little bit of something to sort of like bind the actual dry breadcrumbs. And then,
so it's almost more like a dough than
kind of. And then, so it'll be more cohesive when you actually like go to brown it or whatever, it'll stay as like a piece, which is kind of what you want, right? Like you want.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably where I would start. And then I might like, and then what you might be able to do is like, you could, the crispy breadcrumbs, like, do you think you're going to use like panko or chapelure or something? Like probably panko, right?
Yeah, I guess so. The original, it doesn't make sense now, but my original test, I was using cornbread crumbs because we had cornbread, that pork belly dish that you tasted actually.
Oh, and that even says, this says cornmeal here.
Yeah, but right, we don't have cornbread anywhere else on this menu, so it wouldn't make sense here. But it could very well be panko,
Yeah, so then like potentially what you could also do is like soak the panko in butter ahead of time, or maybe even brown it in butter. Mm-hmm. Like maybe you could pre-toast the panko in butter, and then like maybe you could make like this breadcrumb kind of like dough that I'm talking about, and that could be sort of like, you could cut the rounds out of that and then sprinkle the bread, like the pre-toasted breadcrumbs on it, like right before you gratin it or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have this little round that's kind of sticky and things are going to stick to it. And then you sprinkle these like really crispy breadcrumbs and cheese on top of that. Once you get it on the tomato, and then pop that under the salamander or something like that. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. It sounds like a really fun problem to try and workshop, though. Like,
okay, let's do it.
Okay, yeah, cool. You can do it at your house?
Sure.
My house?
Sure.
My kitchen's... Well, I don't have a salamander. And I don't have a torch either, so...
You have a broiler?
I do have a broiler. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kate.
Okay.
Put it in your calendar.
Yeah, when are we going to do that, Alan? Same day that we go get it. Chicken ice cream sandwich.
Yeah. Well, in one day we'll go eat at Steel Wheels, Shanghai 456, Swiss Chalet, and then we'll make fried green tomatoes together.
Make fried green tomatoes with a perfect little tweel on top.
Okay. The next one.
Okay.
I'm excited to tell you about because this is actually this is an entirely new menu except for this dish here. Okay. And it's because I wanted to make my pierogies better.
Cool.
Because we talked about the pierogi dish last year.
Right. After I had tried it.
Yeah. And one of your comments, which really resonated with me, we were boiling and then frying the pierogies so they're crispy.
Right. They were fried on one side, right? Maybe that was my suggestion
exactly,
or something.
But what you mentioned was that, especially because I was trying to make the comparison or trying to like make the pierogi dish seem like a really elegant ravioli dish or like some kind of like great filled pasta dish, you mentioned that it was kind of missing the like supple texture that you would get from like a buttered ravioli dish. And I totally get that. And I was like, oh, but I do really like the texture. Like I like the crispiness. And so here's the dish: pierogies, cottage cheese filling, cream of leek and mushroom, bacon fried krishtiki, and dill.
Okay.
And so
what's a krishtiki?
Krishtiki is krishtiki is in quotation marks. A real krasniki is like a Polish or Ukrainian dessert or treat where it's basically fried dough. They have a particular shape and everything, but it's really crispy fried dough that's tossed with icing sugar. But the idea here is I've kind of tweaked my pierogi dough to make sure it's nice and soft. These pierogies will be boiled to order and then nestled into the cream of leek and mushroom so that you get, it's all very soft and silken and supple.
Right.
Which is what we want. One of the issues with pierogies, especially on a restaurant menu, is all the trim. Mm-hmm. And so I took the trim and I deep fried it basically so that it's
right.
It puffs and gets crisp and golden brown. And then this is used as kind of like a breadcrumb kind of topping for the pierogi. So you get the like soft suppleness of the pierogies themselves, but then you get these nice big like crunches from this fried dough.
That sounds great. So when you say bacon fried, do you mean that they're fried in bacon fat? Or are you going to fry them in bacon fat and put crispy bacon in with it? Or
the idea was because, and again, maybe this is another thing that would need to be tweaked. Like we might be running into too many smoked and bacony things on this part of the menu. But the idea was that if potentially there was going to be like cooked crumbled bacon in the fried green tomato topping, that we would end up with bacon fat that could be used.
Right.
And so if you added a small amount of bacon fat to the oil that you're frying the krasniki in, then it would get a little bit of the bacon flavor that a lot of people associate with pierogies. But the kind of annoying thing is that the fried green tomato dish and the pierogi dish would be really easy to make vegetarian, but I'm just kind of like sneaking bacon into it.
Right.
So this is all up for editing.
Well, I don't know about in the fried green tomato dish, but definitely in the pierogi dish. Feels like bacon really belongs there.
Yes. Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what you could do to potentially accommodate... Well, yeah, I don't know if you want to make the vegetarian option an accommodation, or if it's just easier if you have the dish be vegetarian and nobody has to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what you could potentially do is like have some krasniki that are reserved for frying not in lard or bacon fat
totally.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be easy to keep it in a deli cup with silica packets and
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds great. I'm excited to try it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your cottage cheese filling.
It is potatoes, peeled, boiled, riced. Cottage cheese is pressed through a chinois.
Okay.
I think that it's... If I remember the test that I did, it was just the potatoes, cottage cheese, and salt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. You're not making this cottage cheese, hey? You're just...
No, although, like, that's actually an interesting question because there's one of the chefs at Nate is a cheesemaker, and like he teaches... Uh-huh. First year culinary students, I think in their cold kitchen class, like he does a cheese making unit. And one of the things that besides just trying to use some of the cheeses that he's making in house, also like getting the students to use some of those fresh cheese recipes in later classes is something that's come up a few times. So that's actually a possibility that the cottage cheese could be made in-house.
I mean, I've made tons of ricotta. I've never actually made cottage cheese, but it seems like, probably one of the more forgiving types of, you know, fresh cheeses that you could make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, seems like, I would probably be trying to take advantage of that option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
Then and since I've never made it, I don't really know, but like you could potentially then also kind of control the size of the curds and things like that. And so you could sort of like try to get it to a situation where like when you mixed in the cheese curds to the potato and stuff, they really like sort of hold up on their own, like, and have like stretch and stuff within the dough, and that could be really interesting as well. Like within the filling. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like I never I've always been so focused on trying to make the filling like so smooth and homogenous like the way it is in commercial ones, but that's an interesting tact to take, like try and accentuate the
Especially if you have that really nice soft, like silky texture of the dough and stuff, but then if there's something that's like, about the filling that's like a little bit surprising or something like
Yeah,
that, it's
totally. Oh,
like,
that's an interesting idea. Yeah.
You're gonna knock it out of the park this year, the pierogi dish.
And then I can take it off the menu.
Yeah, exactly. Once you're satisfied, then. But if you don't have pierogies on there, then where's your Ukrainian representation gonna come from?
Borscht. Just kidding. I
Ah, fair.
don't know. And so our last appetizer is our menu reads charred peppers, spicy beef filling, fried halloumi, fava, mint, and parsley.
Okay. Charred peppers. So, are you thinking bell peppers?
Baby bell peppers.
Okay. Little guys. Okay. And then are you going to, like, I'm reading charred peppers, but my brain is saying stuffed peppers. Is that what this is? Yeah, okay.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And so, but there's something that's like so amazing about like actually like charring the skins off peppers with that method. So is that sort of what you're planning, is to like do that, like, charring the skin off the peppers over an open flame, and then putting them in something to steam the skins off, and then like pull all the skins off,
Yes.
and then use the body of the pepper once it's been charred and had the skin removed to kind of create a stuffed pepper out of it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
It sounds like a really cool idea. I feel like it might be very difficult to get them to be the right shape to still look like a little pepper after you do all that to them, like, because most of the time when you char peppers, you just wind up with strips,
Yes.
you know?
Yeah.
So
So
that
tell.
sounds tricky, but
Can I tell you a technique that I've tried?
hell yeah.
So like you're right. Like if you did it, certainly if you did it on a grill, but probably even if you did it over like the open gas flame on the stove, you mean like the flesh, by the time the skin was blackened, the flesh underneath would be like so
Too
soft.
cooked to really keep
Yeah.
its structure.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah. So what I have tried is you take the baby peppers, really lightly coat them with oil, and then use a blowtorch.
Right.
And then you can get really quick, like you can blacken the skins really quick while a lot of the flesh, I know this like changes the flavor, but a lot of the flesh isn't really cooked at all, actually. So
Right.
you've
Okay.
blistered the skin and it wipes away, like it wipes away very cleanly. But then you still have essentially an intact pepper,
Pepper that you can
or
stuff.
yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And then what I tried was like if you can picture that skinned pepper like just lying on the counter, if you like cut the top off so that, sorry, not the top like where the stem is, but cut that entire top lengthwise. So that it's almost like you're making a little coffin, like a little casket. So the pepper's lying on its side and you kind of scalp it lengthwise.
Okay. So that it's like, so that it comes up around still. It's not just like a half a pepper, it's like a three
Yeah,
quarters of a pepper.
exactly. Yeah. And then you can scoop out, well, the baby peppers don't have very much inside, but scoop out whatever's inside, fill it, and then put the top back on, and it still looks like just a regular old pepper, except.
But like skinned and charred and.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds really cool. Maybe like slice a little bit off the bottom so they sit on the plate nicely as well. And then spicy beef filling. The verbiage there definitely has to change, I feel like.
Because it sounds like something from Arby's, is that what you mean? Or
kind of, yeah. It just sounds very nonspecific and doesn't really, you know, like, I mean, I, you know, like I'm sure I have a pretty good idea of what you're going for. There's probably going to be some kind of harissa type of,
something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Probably just something maybe a little more specific, like what cut of beef are you using, maybe, or, you know, what type of spicing are you using or something like that.
Right.
And then the fried halloumi, what's the idea there? Is that just going to be like a bed for the little pepper, or are you going to, how are you going to incorporate that?
the jumping off point for this was, I really like Greek food and taverna food, and I really love, there's like always stuffed peppers, usually like filled with rice and ground meat. And so I wanted to try and make the composed fine dining plate version of that. And then just my mind was in the thinking about Greek mezes and taverna food. And so I just thought of fried halloumi. So the one test that I did of this, there was three of those small stuffed peppers. And then there was, or sorry, what I can't remember, two or three of the small stuffed peppers. And then there was also just two or three little squares of fried halloumi on the plate with them. The way I've done it in that first iteration, they're just like completely separate. They're not integrated in any way, the halloumi and the stuffed peppers, but they're just on the plate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you have fava, mint, and parsley. And so when you say fava, are you thinking actual like clean little beans, or are you thinking maybe like more of like a fava bean hummus type of situation?
Maybe both. I was just thinking that like with like a kind of sausage-esque, like the beef filling, like would be like a fatty sausage kind of filling, and like cheese, that it might be good to have something a little bit starchy on the plate to
like the beef filled peppers and the halloumi. That is like the richest thing, you know, like it's actually kind of tough, I find, to put halloumi in a dish and not have it be kind of like overpoweringly rich and salty. You really need to, you need something to play off of it. I mean, olive oil goes a long way, you know, to kind of like cutting a little bit of that, like, but you know, cause like, and if you're like frying in an olive oil and then there's some residual olive oil or something like that really helps. Like in most of the dishes where you wind up with fried halloumi, there's also some kind of like olive oil type of dressing or something. And if you use sort of like a slightly kind of bitter, peppery olive oil, it can kind of like not help like trade away from the richness, but just help balance a little bit. But yeah, you need something like mint is a big deal and will probably play a big role in this dish. I could see like both the mint and parsley are like a great idea for this, but yeah, it's, I feel like it's going to be, the trick is going to be making it cohesive so that you can eat the halloumi and eat the stuffed peppers, but not have those two things feel like they're two different dishes, you know?
So for the fava, the idea was potentially to cook the beans, maybe reserve the prettiest ones, and then make something like a hummus with the rest.
Right.
And so that's
with
kind
like
of
a ton like, of mint in it probably as well, something like have like a really kind of minty kind of and then also have like mint leaves or mint oil or something like that. Mint oil is pretty tricky, but I feel like, you know, keeping the color and flavor of mint is, I don't know, the color and flavor of mint is pretty ephemeral.
Okay.
Browns, it bruises like so easily and stuff, but I'm sure one of the herb oil methods that we've talked about on the show probably, you know,
The one test I did of this, I didn't have fava beans, but it was just kind of like a placeholder, but I had artichoke. And so I did like an artichoke puree and some of the artichoke like petals or whatever, as garnish as well.
Oh, that's a cool idea actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that idea. I mean, I feel like potentially that doesn't necessarily add as much freshness, but, but I really like it like as an idea, like, and I don't know, like it's kind of cool. Like I feel like probably students don't get to work with artichokes tons. Right. They probably get a class at some point, like one day somewhere where they have to clean some,
right,
just so that they're maybe like not, familiar with it. But yeah, but maybe not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we touched them like once during my apprenticeship, and it was mostly just to make sure that people knew that they could keep things from browning by putting them in acidulated water.
Right. I see.
You know, like, yeah. But yeah, I really do like the artichoke idea. And like, you know, you could dress artichokes in a way that would really, you know, like add some like freshness to the dish. You know, like you could do something similar, I feel like. Mm-hmm. You could have artichoke or fava play a pretty similar role in the dish,
right,
and do different things with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about petals, like giving people artichoke petals that they have to consume or like chew on or something.
Oh yeah. And sorry, like this was, like I said, it was just like a placeholder because I didn't have the beans, but it was like, it was canned artichokes.
Oh, okay.
So they were cooked, like they were tender. Yeah.
Yeah. I got you. Yeah. You can make like this like super bright kind of hummusy thing with fava beans that I think would be great.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation. But yeah, like I guess my sort of like main concern is how do you plate it in a way that it's going to feel cohesive, where the halloumi is going to feel like a part of the, like it's going to feel like it's together with the stuffed peppers, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you go to a Greek taverna, yeah, you get a bunch of stuff on a plate, but it's not trying to be cohesive,
right?
You know, yeah. Like it's trying to offer you a whole bunch of different stuff that you want to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, like, but this has to somehow come together.
I have a picture of that first plate I made, so I'll share it and you can let me know what you think.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So, yeah, like we haven't even touched the main courses yet.
No.
So like legitimately, I think we should split this into two episodes. And
yeah, totally.
I'm like, and there'll be lots to talk about with the mains, and they look delicious and interesting to talk about. So we should definitely maybe just plan that to be our next episode.
Sure.
But before we sign off or whatever, I guess like the other thing that I'm kind of curious about is because like you said that you were kind of excited after going away to the Naramata to come back and, you know, re-look at this menu with fresh eyes and see if there were things that, you know, like you think like takeaways that you had from going to the Naramata that you might want to try and incorporate. Is there specific stuff on any of these starters that's kind of like, oh yeah, well there's this one technique that I saw that I think could really work here, or is anything springing to mind with your freshly Naramata'd eyes?
For these starters, I think because like I actually have attempted four of the six that we talked about, the quinoa salad, the smoked trout rillette, the pierogies, and the charred peppers. I have actually made and plated those. And so for those ones, they're close enough to being fleshed out that I don't think I don't have anything that I saw or tasted or made at the Naramata Inn that would change those. The mains, right, however, because I got sick, I haven't made a single one. Think there there'll be a little bit more opportunity to try and they will change a lot more than the starters.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you'll be wanting to pull in some more like recent inspiration. Whereas with the starters, you kind of like have a pretty good picture of most of them in your head already from like attempting them already and stuff.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. That'll be, I guess, maybe more of a talking point on our next episode then. So, but you haven't plated the chicken ravioli in broth.
That's right. Yeah.
Is there anything from the Naramata that, like, that one seems like sort of the most sort of just like skeletal framework for a dish idea. Is there anything, they have any kind of brothy dishes on their menu?
They didn't have a soup.
They didn't have a soup.
They had the only brothy dish.
Wow, how modern.
The only brothy dish was the halibut dish that we talked about. That was halibut served with clams in a Chardonnay and kelp broth.
Oh, cool. Right. Got it. Chicken and kelp broth. Got it.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.